I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of August. We have two really interesting shows for you today. We're going to start with Democratic architecture. Donald McDonald is our guest, an architect who wrote this really lovely book to inspire those in our country's private and public sectors to build safe, comfortable, and affordable homes for all people. And he's been doing that for many years now in the San Francisco area. So if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. Donald is our guest. He's the designer of the new Bay Bridge East Span in San Francisco. And he is the owner and principal of McDonald Architects. He has more than 40 years' experience in architecture, planning, contract documents, construction management. He's designed a variety of award-winning projects and has traveled to over 80 countries to observe the housing conditions that exist in both democratic and also in totalitarian government systems. He is with us this hour to talk about every human being's right to a home and how we can accomplish that in this country and all over the world. Our two of our program will speak with, and she has Wisconsin ties now, a North Korean defector, and she has written a book, The Girl with Seven Names, A North Korean Defector's Story. She married a young man from Wisconsin, actually, from the Milwaukee area, so she will be with us to talk about her escape as a teenager from North Korea and what she has done since then. It's a fascinating story and book. So we're looking forward to that interview. And housing, it's all good today. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hi, Donald. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for taking the time to put me on your program. It sounds like a great program.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a really good conversation today. Let's just start with this information that you present early in the book of the number of people who are living in cities and elsewhere with skyrocketing housing prices. It is really expensive housing.
Yeah, I think the thing is, I mean, we really see it in the Bay Area because we have an influx of young, intelligent people, well-educated, getting high wages, and so the people that have lived in some of these areas are lower income, and so it's been kind of a shock in many areas because everybody wants to live in the city, and if you work for Google, you know, they send buses in and into the city to pick you up, take you back to your workspaces in the peninsula. So that's really an unusual situation, and people don't want to live in the suburbs, at least the young people that are coming here, they want to live in the city, and a lot of them are now raising young families in the city, which, you know, I've been in San Francisco many years, and my children grew up in the city, and they love the city. But a lot of young couples, I mean, not so much today, but in my time, say 20, 30 years ago, they would have children go to the suburbs, children grow up, and they leave the suburbs, and in some cases, they come back to the city. So I've been trying to develop situations where when that happens, you never really leave the city if you can set it up in a way and have a housing product or something that can handle that. Mm-hmm. And a transition period. So, and in the book I talk about, that's one part I talk about, like I call a convertible townhouse, that you can make it into two units, and when you're young, you rent out one unit that helps you pay the mortgage on the whole building. When you have family, you turn it into a one-unit house, and then when you get older, you turn it back to two units, so that can help you cover your costs and the mortgage is paid off. So I push that idea, and there's a lot of other ideas I've been pushing, but the main thing is to get people to live back to, in villages and not spread out all over the fringes of cities and things like that.
Do you think that the field of architecture, Donald, has been dominated by people who are trying to make a whole lot of money on the houses that they build, and they're making houses for very, very wealthy people and not for everybody else like us?
Yeah, I think that the way I look at it as an architect is most architects, you know, there's no money in doing affordable housing in fee.
Right.
And people don't, like the private sector doesn't like to build it because they make more money building for the upper elements of, you know, in our society, the higher wage earners and things like that. So there's a, I'd say 60% of the population has a tough time. It might in some areas get down to 40 or 30, and or areas where we live it might be up to 60. So the idea is to develop a housing ladder where they can get in, and, you know, at a fair price for rent or in a mortgage. So that's why I've shown different examples in my book, things that I've done myself and tested it on the market.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've done a lot of nonprofit housing work, and most of that's in the book. And I'm using examples how urban infill mixed use is important. I'm also really been pushing, this hasn't worked very well so far, but you take these huge shopping centers that have these big parking lots.
Right.
And the shopping center in the middle really is the center of a village. And if you just put a platform on top of that parking and put townhouses on it, you've got a complete suburban village. So I pushed that idea. And I've got a couple of those, but we started out as mixed use. It wasn't a shopping center. It was a shopping center site, but it was turned into kind of a, what I call a suburban village, where you can live and work and be in the same area. At least you're able to shop, walk to a store, a Safeway, or some other kind of store that has
right.
food, so you don't need the car to get everything and go everywhere.
Yeah. Tell me about, as long as you brought up suburban living, let's talk about suburbia for a moment. I know
sure.
you have environmental concerns about the expansion of homes
right.
way outside of cities.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been curtailed at all, or is that still where people are going?
No, I think that, to be fair, in a democracy, you should have a choice. But I think what's happening is that the costs to do that, you know, on the community are quite heavy because the utility lines, the water lines, the sewer lines, the roadways, it's a lot of stuff to serve very few people, you know, and that burden is carried on taxes by everybody else. And so I think from that point of view, it's not an economical solution. But, you know, my theory, again, is if in a democracy, you should have that opportunity because some people want it, you know, so... It's something that shouldn't be outlawed, but what I find, like I mentioned earlier, is that people that do that and have the children, like my kids are the same way. I have grandchildren now, and now they're concerned about, you know, where they're going to go to school, and the best schools are more in an urban area, and just a lot of stuff. So they're moving into higher density area than where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And when those children go, they'll move back into the city.
Let's talk about low-income housing for a moment. It
sure.
seems as though there hasn't been a lot of construction of low-income housing. You have some very interesting ideas in your book and pictures of housing projects, old housing projects that have collapsed in this country, and some new ideas for housing projects. Are we paying attention to low-income people who need housing subsidies and what's being built that's creative and affordable?
Well, some cities, like San Francisco, and there's a few other cities in California, they've stopped the redevelopment agency. Jerry Brown, our governor, shut it down. And so now cities are requiring developers that build rental units, for instance, to set so many units aside in a project that can be anywhere from 10 to 20%. Or if they don't do that, they put up the money, and that goes into the coffers of the city, and that money set aside by the cities to build affordable housing. And then there's nonprofits will come in and do that. But you can't cover large swaths of the population. It's not big enough. And when they killed off, at least in California, the redevelopment agencies, they sort of blunted an area that was providing a lot of that housing,
mm-hmm.
even though it wasn't efficiently done, and that's why they shut it down. But it was something that needs to be done. Most countries in the world, the Western world, they subsidize housing. You know, Holland's a fine example of that. And so you don't find, you know, people that have worked hard in their life and gotten older, and they really suffer where they live because they can't afford it, and prices continue to go up. So it's a tough world.
You have some pictures, and you've done some of these homes that are really amazing. They're very small, but they don't look that small. They're using every available space, sometimes lofts for bedrooms, really inexpensive housing that seems to be pretty solidly made. And when you become a little bit more affluent, you can add on.
Yeah, that was the idea. I call them starter houses. I mean, there's two types. One is a house that is it's only 14 feet by 17 feet, but it has everything in it and has a loft to sleep. It's a starter house, but it's designed so that you can add these boxes. In other words, let's say if you had a quarter of an acre lot, you could add the same size box to each side of this house, and eventually you get a house that's a lot bigger than what you started with. And as you accumulate money or children, or you can add these boxes. So that's one type. The other one that I did was a 20 by 20. That's 400 square feet on the ground floor, and it's an 800 square foot house, and it can be two bedrooms or three bedrooms and one bath, and has a loft in it as well. And that house, you can put it in urban areas. I've encouraged cities to use what I call cottage zoning, where you're allowed to put like maybe... You have a city lot, like in San Francisco, you have a lot that's 25 feet by 125 feet, and I can get four of those on that lot.
Mm.
you know, instead of putting one house on it, you put four. But they're these small ones, and they're starters. And those, too, can be expanded. They have to be expanded vertically if you want to go up another floor or something. But so the idea is to get people in the door. And I'm not pushing the style of architecture. I'm pushing the way you use space and how you can do it efficiently. And so, and I do things like I put the living room on the second floor in most cases because it's, you use less lumber if you put it up there because you don't need to carry the weight of a, like a bedrooms and bathrooms above it.
Mm-hmm.
Put that on the first floor so you save money on the materials and I size it, and boxes are not as expensive to build as rectangular houses. So I get into a lot of the details like that, but just general thinking so the reader of the book can understand that every detail counts for affordability.
Mm-hmm.
But also the ability that each user comes in can adapt it to their use and change the facade. And so, I said, I'm not pushing architecture in the sense that it's a piece of visual, you know, a piece of beauty. It's more a functional thing that can be adapted to the user. And
yeah.
I use this common shape of a house that little children draw, so it has a sense of home.
Right. But they're also darn cute, I think, these cottages.
Yeah, I think if they're well done and designed and thoughtful, they can be dynamite. You can make them look big or small in some cases.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about the detached houses. These are something that you can see all around the city of Milwaukee because particularly
right.
Polish immigrants built little houses, usually in back of their house, for their parents to live in. And this is really a good idea, right? That if you're anticipating taking care of your parents as they get older, it may not be a bad idea before they get really old to get one of these houses. And maybe youngsters who haven't quite made it on their own yet can live in this little detached house that's near your house.
No, I think it's a great idea. In fact, I've been pushing things like that for in San Francisco, the in-law unit. And sometimes,
right.
like that one house I've designed, it's 14 feet by 17, and that's not very big. And you put that in the backyard, and it's got a kitchen and a bathroom and a little loft. And, you know, it's a pretty nice place. And so, and it's all easily built. It's all what I call nail-on technology. There's nothing in there that has to be particularly fitted, like, you know, difficult wood joints. Anybody can sort of hammer it together. So I really agree with you. And that's, again, this idea of a multi-generational kind of situation where when you're young, you can rent it out. Or you can, you know, help pay the mortgage with somebody living in that little house. Then when you have children, you can expand to that little house. And then when you get older, you rent it back out again, or when you need help with your parents or they need help, they can move into that house and keep an eye on them and they babysit for you. There's just a lot of things that have flexibility that gives you outdoor space but also privacy. So I think that you brought up a good point there.
Mm-hmm. And you can really build these yourself?
Yeah, you can.
Really?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that's amazing. That would be a terrific feeling of accomplishment to build your own little house, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, that idea sort of comes down the line from Frank Lloyd Wright, because Frank Lloyd Wright designed a house where you could build it out of concrete blocks, and all you'd have to do is get a batch of concrete and make five different concrete blocks and multiples, and then you can put them in different places, and that's your house, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's plumbing and things like that, but even that, you can bring plumbers in to do that stuff. But you can do the framing and, you know, all the handiwork that hammers and saw do.
Hmm. What about this idea? I hadn't really thought about this very much before, Donald. People, you write, move into homes that are designed according to someone else's specifications and then forced to adapt as best they can to the space and other conditions beyond their power to change. And what we're looking at is a basic deprivation of freedom that has existed for so long, you say it's never been seriously questioned.
Yeah, I think what they do is, like, when a developer builds a large project, many of them get focus groups, and they try to anticipate what the average buyer would want. And what I've done with all my stuff, is I've always set it up in a way that it's built for change, you know, so you can change anything you want, facades, interiors, and if you have these large complexes that are, like, with homeowners associations, condominiums, and things like that, they usually set the kind of curtains you can use, the color of your building and all that stuff in your unit.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I don't do that. I encourage, you know, variety so you can see what I call democracy in action, where individuals are doing their own thing and, you know, being respectful of others. But usually when you do things like that, you do appreciate other people's opinion and you don't try to disrupt the community. So I think that open-ended situation is much more, you know, in the nature of the human being to have his own thing. And so if in some of these little houses I've done, if you go back say 5-10 years later, they've changed the facade around, they've had some trellising, or, you know, they've done a lot of things to personalize, and I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. You also have some very interesting pictures and ideas for people who really don't have a housing, for people who are homeless, for people who may live in mobile homes, for people who, for shelters that are on streets that keep you out of the elements. They're really interesting designs and fulfill this idea that you have, that a house is a right that everybody should have.
Yeah. I started that homeless business looking at the condition in my office building. I had a parking lot that I'd rented from the Department of Transportation in California. And these guys were living on the ground. There's two of them, so I decided to do what I call a city sleeper, and I let them live in there. And then I got these chemical toilets used in a construction site.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I think, a local church, or I guess two blocks away, and they go down there and eat. So they're there for about a year. And then I got in trouble with the Department of Transportation, and, you know, I got a few lawsuits and all that out of it. But the point I was trying to make was that you can do basic elements, and I was trying to get Mayor Feinstein at the time, who's now a senator, to allow me to go under freeways and start doing these things in small batches, you know. And now the idea was to trigger the idea to say, look, it, you can go one step further and give them a space. You know, it doesn't have to be big, but just give them a lockable space so they can get in there and get in there. They wouldn't get beaten up and all that stuff.
Right.
So the idea was to start this, what I call a housing ladder, so they can get in the door. But I show examples, as you know, in the book of the city sleeper, and then I show a trailer, and then I show a van. I know a young friend of mine when we were young. He lived in a van for about 2 months. He was traveling around the nation. He said, it's pretty interesting, you know. So I took that idea, and then I did a van for Family Circle magazine based on all the equipment you can buy from Coleman and different companies like that. So the idea is to keep studying this business in small houses and bigger houses and then full urban complexes that were mixed use. So
right.
That's part of the whole system.
Yeah. And what are these city sleepers? What do they look like?
They're 6 sheets of plywood all sort of nailed together in the box, and they have a flap on it that acts as a like a door, but also a sunshade. And then there's 4 auto jacks underneath it, so you can adjust it to the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside we have a 4-inch foam floor on it, and then we have like shelving at one end. And then we have vents at each end of it, so you can vent the air through it in a window. And they're lockable from the inside, because when you're homeless and you're on the street, a lot of guys will fight you and pick on you while you're sleeping, and, you know, stuff like that. So the idea is to get them off the street and into a space that's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't realize, but if people have been on the street, they live about 5 years and then they die, because it's just pretty rough, you know. There's other reasons, drugs and all that,
right,
just in general. And, you know, if you go to Sweden or Scandinavian countries, you know, there's a place for these guys to go. But here, at least in our city, there's no place for most of them to go.
Yeah, why?
Well, the taxpayers don't want to allocate the money, and when they try to do it, they put them usually in big dorms, and there's no privacy, and they you know, get them out by 6 in the morning, and they're on the street, and they have to get in by, I can't remember the hours now, but by 7 o'clock or something. And then they don't like to, they just, they're free thinkers, you might say, and they don't like to be corralled like that, so they wander. You know, it's really individualistic, but
right,
it's the families that you really see suffering that really gets you. The woman's addicted to this heroin or something, and she's got 2 kids. And
yes.
And that's really a tragedy, whereas in most Western countries, you know, there's places for them to go.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is a longtime architect, Donald McDonald, and he is the author of this really interesting book that makes you think about housing for everybody in a whole new way. Democratic Architecture is the name of the book. He has done some interesting projects. He's based in San Francisco, so he's done, if you can believe it, it's not an oxymoron, real affordable housing in the San Francisco area. He designs bridges as well. He's traveled all over the country looking at housing conditions in a variety of political settings, and has some very interesting ideas about lower middle income housing, with an emphasis on increasing opportunities for home ownership. Some very interesting designs of very small houses that you can make larger, and ideas which I said we have here in Milwaukee and probably other communities in Wisconsin, an in-law house or a house for your young children as they're trying to set out in the world, or and maybe they'll take your house and then you live in this little house that's in the yard somehow. It's really interesting ideas. How do we make sure that everybody has a home? He believes we all have a right to a home, a private, secure, and congenial, I like that phrase, place to live at an affordable cost, or in the case of the destitute, at no cost at all. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. We have lines open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Donald McDonald, Democratic Architecture is what we're talking about, and our number is 800-486-8655. We start our calls with Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you for this really interesting show. Mr. McDonald, bless your heart.
Thank you.
You're very inspiring. I wonder if you've heard of a low-cost building technique called papercrete.
No, I haven't.
It's concrete, paper, and water. Mix it together in a slurry. You can pour it into a form.
Okay.
A friend of mine in New Mexico has been working with it for years. I believe he's gone to Mexico and built shelters and communities. It's very low cost. It works up here in this part of the world. A potter friend of mine got together with this other guy, and they built a studio out of it, and it has held up through many a Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin winter.
It's called I'll have to Google that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
Yeah. Fran called in, and she was interested in these small units built in the backyard. She's wondering if that gets complicated with ordinances and zoning.
Yeah, I think that what happens is that you have to check your zoning, because if you're in a single-family area and there's setbacks and things like that, that you'd have to try to get a variance in that permit. You know, planning is the big problem with that kind of stuff. So.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what they do, if you put a unit back there, they want another parking space or two spaces or something. But, you know, you have to pioneer some of these things, which I've done, and sometimes it works, so...
Right. I know that you have done lectures and looked at housing all over the world, Donald. You mentioned some of the Scandinavian countries. Are there places that you looked at and you said, oh, my gosh, this is terrific. I want to do it back in California.
It's really hard to do that because most of the ones I've seen are really heavily subsidized. And I've tried to set up a system that where you can get in the private sector can, you know, deal with that level of housing. And also, like, I've done a lot of affordable housing, was subsidized, but it's hard to get that money today. So it's kind of not the same. Even when I was in Moscow and in Kiev and places like that, you know, the state builds all the housing, you know, and you sort of line up to get it. And you get a big concrete box, and then you go inside and redecorate it yourself. So.
Mm-hmm. And, Marty, I meant to tell you, send us more information on the kind of housing that you were talking about. It sounds really interesting. Dave is our next caller. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, it sounds like your guest is a great person who's doing some great things. And I'm wondering, you know, taking an interest in doing something like this myself in the future, perhaps if I could have some kind of a factory that would make something useful or new, and building something like that kind of near the factory or attached to it, you know, so it'd be a place for the people to work, you know, because if the renters had their money, made their money working in the same neighborhood, they'd, you know, they could pay a high enough rent that they take pride in how well they take care of the place. There's so many of the low-income units that I see deteriorate real quick if the rent is too low, and most of the landlords end up putting most of their income back and fixing things to maintain a place. You know, there's always, you know, things going wrong in any kind of rental thing. And I'm wondering what you think of that sort of idea, and how do you narrow down which renters get an opportunity to pay and live in your new housing units? Is it hard to narrow down who gets it?
Actually, the nonprofits that I work with, they have a whole system, you know, and usually it's the most needy, but also somebody that isn't on drugs and doesn't cause problems in the community. And so sometimes those people do come into these projects and then they have to oust them out again. But or sometimes they'll take a homeless and use it as transitional housing and it'll work out. So it's quite complicated, actually. But anytime we've done affordable housing for a nonprofit, there might be, say we do 50 units, there might be 3,000 families that line up to get them. So you can really see how how the need is huge. And the way to avoid a lot of these problems is to do what I call this detached housing, where you can get densities up to 20 units an acre, where everybody has a home and a yard, even if it's rental. But if you keep it at two stories and wood frame, you can keep the cost down. That's about as low as you can build in the cost factor of construction. So if you go any more than that, then you get into more expensive construction. So the idea is to keep the density down where you don't have a garage, you have on-surface parking. You try to have no more than 1.5 cars per unit, and then you have one per unit, and then the one half unit, you might say, is shared by guests and whoever's visiting. But the idea is to get them in the door and then let them get on the housing ladder if they can climb further and get bigger spaces somewhere else. But at least get the door open. So minimal spaces with detached elements, so they take care of the unit. Like a lot of the problems with the maintenance is always if you're in apartment buildings and people treat the hallway as a street, and it gets kind of messy. And whereas if you have your own house and your own entry and your own yard, even though the yard might be 10 feet by 20 feet, it's still important.
I know you build bridges too. You're a specialist in bridge design, Donald?
That's true. A lot of bridges all over the nation.
Yeah. I every time I'm on a bridge, particularly one that's very beautiful, I think this must be so hard to build. Is it much, much more difficult than building a house?
Oh, it's incredibly difficult.
Is it?
Yeah, the politics, they go on for years. Like, I've been on the Bay Bridge for 18 years.
Whoa!
Yeah. But we just finished one in Portland that's just dynamite. And if you ever want to Google it, you can go to KGW. I did a 5-minute television show on it, and you can see how it really fits in the community. The community is raving over it, so it's a. But I do them. I did in Charlotte, North Carolina, and different areas of the United States doing them. So, but I have two basic loves. One is to get the infrastructure in America up to par and make it as beautiful as possible, and getting bridges to brand themselves with cities, and then the others to get everybody a home in the United States. So, I mean, who knows if it'll ever make it, but at least to show examples, that's why I put the book out, because there are solutions. You've got to get the cities to do what I call cottage zoning, so you can get smaller units on a lot, and a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah. And what about the state of bridges in the country? Could we put a whole lot of people to work building the...
Oh, yeah. Every time, we just about got the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York. We're second low bidders on it. And that one, they'll put thousands of people to work for the next 5 years.
Remarkable.
All the small industries. In fact, that's another political ploy, is that you got to get the funding out of Congress to do these bridges. The infrastructure is just a mess,
And
there's like 450,000 bridges in the United States, and about 20% of them need to be replaced or fixed up. And it's just it's ridiculous for a nation that this has this kind of money that... We have housing and infrastructure problems, and it's pretty hard to handle emotionally because it's not worth it.
Did you choose to do bridges when you were studying architecture?
Well, what happened was that I happened to go to an architecture school. We were part of the engineering department, so I had a fairly good background in engineering as well as just architecture. And I was good at sciences, and I'm also an artist, and I illustrate and all that. So I blended the two, and architecture sort of comes at that point. And I started out in bridges. I redesigned the Golden Gate Bridge toll plaza, and it took off from there. Somebody wanted a person that had done bridges, and I was probably the only guy that's really done bridges. So that was about 20 years ago, so I've been doing them ever since.
A message on Facebook from Jenny. Do you, Donald, know if there are any creative ways that metro areas are repurposing boarded-up foreclosed homes?
I don't know of any, but I know that in California, in the northern part up here, that we have high-density housing at these stations. And it's to get housing for people. That helps a lot in areas that have been boarded up where they're close to transportation. And so, like, some nonprofits have come in certain areas where we live in Oakland and in Richmond and places like that, where they're near the freeways or they're near the BART system. and they've been able to be successful with that. So,
Neil in Bark River, hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Neil.
Thanks for letting me be on the show.
Sure.
My question is about the licensing of the architectural plan for these homes. Since you work with a nonprofit, are these like general public license or available to everybody, or do you have to pay to get the plans if you're say if you want to get those houses by yourself?
Yeah, actually, if you want plans for this little house, there's a service called House Plans that sells them. You know, you can buy them and for the 14 by 17 or the 20 by 20, and then I've done some townhouses 12 feet wide and 30 feet long, and they sell the plans, so you can get them there.
From the nonprofit organization that you work for?
No, that's not mine. It's just it's a company that sells house plans, and I made a deal with them a number of years ago. If people want to build little houses that are in the book, they can, you know, you can Google that if you want.
Huh?
They're for sale. They're fairly inexpensive.
Hmm.
Okay. Are these prefabricated wall panels?
No, they're just stick built.
Okay.
You could prefab them, but
thank you very much. Love your show. Have a good day.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks very much
Thank
for
you.
The call. Did you finish what you wanted to say, Donald? You said they're... I don't know if we left you in mid-sentence.
No, I said they... excuse me, I was coughing. I think I was just saying that the plans are available through this company called House Plans. You can Google it and, you know, order them.
Great. Okay, company called House Plans. Great. Elise writes on Facebook, my husband and our young children have enjoyed learning about the tiny house movement. We embrace the idea that our special needs child may do well living in a tiny house in our backyard as an adult.
That's great. They should get that 14 by 17 foot house.
Absolutely. It would
yeah,
be perfect,
right.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it's inexpensive to build.
Yeah. Neil, thanks so much. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, thanks for putting on this show. It's really an excellent topic, especially here in Milwaukee. We have so many homeless people, and I really enjoyed this about the small houses, the little houses, and your housing for homeless people, because I work on the lakefront in Milwaukee, and during the summer I see these homeless guys that are trying to hide out from the police down here at our parks, and I would never report them to the police because they're doing what they can to sleep on a bench that's kind of hidden from view. And if they had just a small space they could go into in the wintertime, I'm sure they would rather do that than go to a lot of the shelters. But I wanted to bring up the idea. I think I saw it in the New York Times, and it was reusing shipping containers, which are all steel, and apparently they become just scrap when they've reached their lifespan. And I think it was Europe and some of the East Coast cities are taking shipping containers and cutting windows and doors into them and then putting partitioning in and turning these containers into these little houses, and then they can stack them on top of each other. And I wonder if you know about that.
Yeah, I do. In fact, I worked for Intel many years ago. They had a lot of surplus housing. I'm not sorry, containers, and I was using them. I was stacking them. And a lot of people are using them now for exhibit halls. They'll have a traveling exhibit, like I think maybe Nike or somebody like that might be using them. But I really agree with you is that they're dynamite housing elements, and they're built to be stacked on top of each other so you could put some outside stairways if you wanted and get to them and put some windows in. And they're not that well insulated, some of them, but in general they're a great idea because you can pump insulation into the walls if you want, drill holes in the inner wall and then just pump the insulation in. So, but it's a sort of thing, but it's getting the zoning and allowing the city to let you do it, and there's stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a political problem.
Yeah. Thank you, Ray, very much for your call. We need to perhaps teach empathy, right, Donald? to make these less political problems because...
Right.
Yeah. Hank in Muskego, hi.
Ah, bonjour. You know, the problem with this is the George Carlin problem. Where are you going to put your stuff?
Donald.
Well, if you're clever, you'll build shelving and, you know, you hang it in nets, I guess. No, but if I always look at it, if you have a small space, the things you have should be high quality, you know, and you shouldn't just pack a lot of junk in there. So, you know, if you, at least that's the way I look at it. In other words, you don't need a big garage if you have a Porsche or something, you know, that type of car. So I think it's what you choose. Like, I happen to collect books, but I just usually get the nicest books I can get, and I don't keep the junk, you know. So I think in general, it's just a matter of learning to live a small space. I notice a lot of young guys here that are working in the computer world, they don't want a big space. They don't want to take care of it. They want to, they live, sort of live outside the unit. They work all the time. They're buying experiences now, not big space. So We're doing a project in Oakland for these sort of computer types in the housing units. There are 360 square feet, and there's little two-story houses, and the second level has a loft. The first floor has kitchens and bathroom, and has a yard and a place for your car outside. And so, and it's, they look like they're quite popular, but they're pretty small.
Hmm. What do you do with all your books?
What do I do?
Yeah, what do you do?
I put a shelf, you know, if you take the top of a door, I run a shelf also around the inside of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, and get two levels of books in there, so you can, that space that's never really used, you know, if you really think about it, if you have an 8-foot ceiling.
Oh, you mean at the top, near the ceiling?
Yeah, exactly. It's, the door is 6'8" usually. Well, above that, there's, from there to the top of the ceiling is, it's in an 8-foot space. You can see that gives you 1'4", and you can have two shelves in there, and you can just run the, around the whole room.
How do you get at the books?
Just get in a chair and take a book. You can get a little three-step ladder if you want, fancy ladder.
All right, well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's what I have. I don't own much but books, and I can't part with them. We're welcoming more phone calls. Our guest is an architect who is giving us terrific ideas for housing for everybody, and he's the author of Democratic Architecture. Donald McDonald is our guest. He's been owner and principal of Donald McDonald Architects for more than 40 years. He's a specialist, you heard him say, in bridge design, but he's also done all kinds of other kinds of projects and has won awards for small houses and for multi-purpose buildings that have, I want to talk more about this, mixed income, if there's a market for that. And I know that here in Milwaukee, a lot of young people have been moving into condos, which now line the river, unbelievably so. It didn't used to be the case, but they can be fairly expensive. So are there ideas for mixing, you know, lower income, because not everybody's making a lot of money, with higher income condos in a very desirable space? What are other cities doing in that regard? Does the idea of mixed kind of housing work? Do people think that's okay? Is it attractive? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls now for Donald McDonald. Mike in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike.
Hello, hello. I just was wondering if the guest would have any thoughts or opinions about the Lustralux attempt at making ultra-modern fireproof housing. It got derailed by corruption, I guess.
Yeah, that was many years ago. Was it in the 50s or...
I guess it was right after the Second World War. Some guy took over a gigantic aircraft factory that was idled.
Yeah, I remember looking at some of those. In fact, I think in your neck of the woods, there's some prototypes that they built that are still in existence. The trouble with prefab is that it has to compete with stick built, and in prefab, you have to keep a big factory.
Special interest of the, you know, lumberjacks that thought it would cut into their business.
Yeah, right. So, but the way to picture it is that when you have a factory, I mean, nowadays it's $5 to $10 million to build that factory, and you have to keep it busy all the time, where a man that does it has a pickup and some equipment can do a house. You know, he doesn't have all that backup. So that stick build always competes with factory, and the factory has a hard time, modules and all, have a hard time beating them. And they really work in remote areas, like out in oil field areas, up in Athabasca, tar sands, places where you can't get the labor to build. You know, it's hard to get. So ski resorts used to use them.
Well, it was largely porcelain steel panel.
Yeah, it was. The one I saw was, yeah.
And I guess the ones that, so they almost last, you know, almost indefinitely, and they're pretty much fireproof.
Yeah, it's too bad that never went ahead because it's a great idea, but I remember looking at it years ago, and because I've done a lot of prefab work for American Plywood and panelizing and things like that, checking stuff out, but it was hard to beat the stick builder because he could adjust to the economy a lot easier and he didn't have to support a factory, so that's always been the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a magazine called Dwell that really pushes modular building, but in the end, prices aren't any different, so...
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call. We go to Matthew in Balsam Lake. Matthew, hi.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
So I live in a 1953 canned ham camper, 12 feet long.
Oh.
And I'm 6'4", so I have a dog when I'm in there. And I've got a 125-pound Neapolitan Mastiff named Sophie that resides in there with me.
Oh.
And we build log cabins.
Oh, my gosh. It's great.
So we go from site to site and kind of, like, camp out and tap into the power source at the job, and the boss is cool with it, and the owners are cool with it, and, I cook on a Coleman stove, and life is great.
How long have you done this?
As long as you have a library card, you're good to go.
Yeah, and a good meal. How long have you done this, Matthew?
About a year, but I've been bopping around kind of doing it for a little bit longer than that with a tent. So, but I bought the camper about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but it's pretty cool, fun.
You should get my book because I've got a camper in there that, you know, we can sleep in, you adjust it, and I use all the Coleman facilities and its sink and all that stuff. So.
I have the sink. I have all the hookups. But, I just took on the Coleman stove because the pipe, the lines were a little bit rotten.
Yeah.
I didn't want I kind of got it out of a guy's old barn he was demolishing.
Oh, yeah.
So the gas lines were a little sketchy. So I just used my Coleman outside.
Matthew, do you have a camera? Can you put it on Facebook?
I don't have Facebook, but I'll try, Kathleen. It might be tomorrow or something.
Okay. We'd love to see it.
I do have photos of it, though.
Great. We'd love to see it.
Wonderful. Hey, love the show. And, hey, these campers are all over the place right now for cheap if you look on Craigslist and stuff. So anybody out there listening, there are ways to really benefit yourself financially looking for housing.
Thanks, Matthew, very much for the call. Well, that was interesting.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that people can live in very small spaces, and that's a great example.
Right.
Yeah.
What about log cabins? I always wanted to live in a log cabin.
Yeah, well, you can get prefab log cabins, you know, and they're great, but they're not any cheaper than a stick-built house, and they use more lumber, so.
Yeah, all right. I'll give up on that dream.
I'd go for it.
I don't know, Matthew's idea sounds pretty good to me with a big old dog. Hey.
Yeah, well, you could get three or four of them and just put a roof between them and probably have enough space for a couple more people.
Yeah. Thanks, Matthew. Beth in Oak Creek. Hi.
Hi. Yeah. We just bought a mobile home in Oak Creek last year. We were living in the inner city, and everybody here loves this place. It's like a campground at night. The number one key seems to be trees.
Oh.
Hmm. That's great. How big is it?
We have a lot of trees.
Yeah.
I have several finches on my shed right now staring me down.
How big is it? How big is the home, mobile home?
It's a 14 by 70, plus we have a 12 by 12 shed and a 9 by 12 porch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of room, more than we had.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was noticing that we were in a little cottage up north a couple weeks ago, Donald, in Wisconsin, and it looked kind of attractive to me. There was a very nice mobile home park, at part of the lake, and I thought, well, this is kind of neat. If you had a mobile home there, you could maybe share it, and it wouldn't be all that expensive, and you're on the water mostly anyhow. It seems like a good way to go.
Yeah, I think it is. I think, in fact, in mobile homes, I've always pushed that idea, affordable housing, because they're movable. And some mobile home parks, you know, they're there permanently, but the idea is you can add decks to them and you can add things to them to make them, you know, more of a space where you can, you know, get outside and stay out of the sun or something, but it becomes more like a regular home.
Right.
But I think that that's absolutely one of the things. And a lot of communities don't like them in the community, so they put them in mobile home parks. But I wouldn't mind seeing them in backyards and things like that, but not everybody agree with me on that, maybe.
Well, I agree with you. A lot of people listening agree with you. We may be outliers, but what the heck.
Yeah, right.
I did want to, because I'm sure this is happening in cities. Well, it is happening in cities all over. So you've got young people who want to live in the cities, and that's a good thing. But you've got young people, many of whom are making a substantial amount of money, and they're buying condos that, at least in this city, in Milwaukee, where I am, are pretty darned expensive. Is there a movement? Does anybody want to have places where you have lower rents for people who want to live in these pretty places, and then you also have condos, sort of mixed income places?
Yeah, in San Francisco we have that. If you're a developer and you build a high rise, but anywhere from 10 to 20% of the units have to be affordable.
Oh, my.
And it's based on your income. They'll take the average income in the city, and if you're 80% or 60% of that, you can qualify for different ones. So they try to make the buildings mix it up, so... Which is, it seems to be working. The other thing they do is they, I think as mentioned earlier, they set money aside. Like if you've got 100 units and you don't want to put them in there, then you have to give the city the amount of money that those units would go for. And then they save that money and they put that in. They have a nonprofit come in and take that money and build housing with it. So, so they go one of two ways, yeah.
Is that unusual in this country, Donald?
I'm not sure in other cities, but it might be unusual.
Right.
Yeah, because here we usually lead the way in many things. So
if you're looking at the greatest need now or the biggest obstacle to everybody being able to have a home as a right, what is it?
I think it's getting higher densities in areas that are not zoned for it, closer to shopping, schools. In other words, if you have a nice big school and you have single-family housing all around it for 4 or 5 miles, you know, that's really not the greatest thing because everybody has to use a car to get there. So you allow higher densities, and like I say, you can go up to 20 units an acre with these small houses, and you can go probably 60 units an acre and still be detached. And I mean, that's 2 inches between your house and the next one, but our city of San Francisco, most of the houses just have that spacing between each house. So it's not unusual, but you know, it covers the idea that you know, you have a detached home, which, you know, 80%+ of Americans would like. Yeah.
Right. Have you always lived in San Francisco?
No, I was a student in New York at Columbia, and I lived in Oklahoma and San Francisco. So I've been around.
Well, it's a beautiful part of the country, but I think people, that's why it's amazing that all your work is coming out of there, because we think of it as, oh, I could never live there. It's just way too expensive.
Yeah, well, my theory was it was the best place to try it out.
Right.
But there's ways you have to read the code. What I would do is give you an idea that I'd take a lot that could take 10 units, and an average builder would do 10 apartments where I did 10 micro houses on it with yards and front doors and all that. That really went over big. And I was selling them. I did it myself sometimes because nobody else would do it. I was selling them for, say, 50 to 100,000 below the market for the same space because I didn't have to have elevators and corridors and all that stuff.
Right.
But now they sell for a lot more money, which is kind of too bad because that wasn't the idea.
No.
But they are still starters.
Mm. Well, Donald, aren't you an interesting guy? Thank you so much
you.
For being with us. It was really great interest from the audience, too. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Donald McDonald, the book is Democratic Architecture, and it got me thinking when we were talking to Matthew about living in his camper with his big dog. If you want to post little pictures on our Facebook page of interesting places that you may be living, your home, we'd love to see them. It's all coming up in my mind now of where people are living. So our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Give us ideas about new ways that we can all live. I knew this was going to be an interesting hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up, and we'll return. Very interesting story from a North Korean defector.